This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. A little rough in the ragged in the lungs, but we're still here. Today we're going to have Dan Gaynor on, who's going to tell us about how the so-called left-wing food police have turned Kellogg's characters into, quote, cereal, C-E-R-E-A-L, killers. Yeah, right. Alan Dershowitz on his new book about how the religious right is hijacking our Declaration of Independence. Best of the rest of the news a little later on from MediaMatters.org and Firedog Lake. And crazy alert involving cats, dogs, chainsaws, and Democrats. No, not Higgins, my cat. In the meantime, a lot in the news, including, and I want to get into this whole issue. Should the rich have an entire tax code just for themselves? And in a way, this also gets into the divide. This, in some level, coming out of the Supreme Court decisions of a couple of days ago. But also gets into the divide between races in the United States, the historic divide between races in the United States that goes back to slavery. And the Supreme Court has just come out with this decision that schools may not consider color, the color of a person's skin. They may not take into account students' race, or at least that's my understanding of it. I wanted to get somebody on who understands this stuff. CRC, Community Rights Council. CommunityRights.org is the website. Community Rights Council, the organization, and Doug Kendall is the Executive Director of Community Rights. Doug, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Tell me about the Supreme Court decision. This is a 5-4 decision. The five Catholic justices on the court, I don't know how else there are the five conservative justices on the court, I guess we should call them, but it seems that there's in any case, they have... how did they rule?
Well, it's a classic reflection of how the court is divided right now. The court actually is divided into three different camps. Justice Kennedy, who sits in the middle, only joined a fairly narrow portion of the majority's ruling or the plurality's ruling. So you have four justices on the right, Justices Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Chief Justice Roberts. You have Justice Kennedy in the middle, and then you have the four moderates or liberals on the right, Breyer, Stevens, Souter, and Ginsburg.
They are not liberals. They are moderates.
No, I think that's right. And
there are no liberals on this court.
You have a Ford Republican. You have a Bush Republican and two Clinton appointees. So, but the opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts would treat efforts to integrate schools, race-conscious efforts to integrate schools, exactly the same as race-conscious efforts to segregate schools. And he would rule essentially that that's what Brown means, that Brown means you can't take any efforts to, at this point, unless there's any efforts to integrate schools just about whatsoever.
Let's just back up a little bit here. By Brown, you're talking about Brown versus Board
Brown
of Education,
Board
which
of
was
education,
in 1954,
classic,
as I recall.
Classic unanimous opinion by the Supreme Court that said that struck down school segregation, and you've had right. a long series of opinions, including a unanimous opinion in the 70s in the Swan case, where the court has said local school districts have a great deal of authority to take race-conscious measures to integrate the public schools, and that would go out the window if the plurality opinion was followed. Now, as I said, I want to be clear here that I think there's a very big distinction between what the plurality would do, what the four conservatives would do, and what Justice Kennedy's separate opinion requires. And if you see the dissent, the vast majority of what they're criticizing is what the plurality would do, not what the majority did do. Obviously, the opinion itself strikes down these particular programs, and that's, I think, plainly the wrong decision and a decision that has pretty
Isn't the essence of this, Doug Kendall, communityrights.org, isn't the essence of this really the position that conservatives have been taking for some time? I mean, I've debated a number of them here on this program, where they're saying, well, you know, we really shouldn't be taking race into consideration. And the assumption underneath it all is that we have reached the point in our society where race isn't a consideration any longer. And it simply belies, it's not true. I mean, you know, race is still a big factor, a huge factor in American life, and the echoes of segregation and slavery and are still very much with us. And I would be the very first to agree with these cons that, you know, wouldn't it be great to have a colorblind society or a classblind society? But the fact of the matter is we don't have one now, and therefore there is still some need for remedial action. And I'm wondering, A, if you agree with that position, and you know that this is basically the conservative position being writ large, and B, what this is going to do to affirmative action programs.
Well, I think it's certainly true that that we are not past race in the society, and any assertion that we are is just not reflective of reality. But I think it's also true that, conservatives often say they are bound by text and history. Well, no one alive at the time the 14th Amendment was passed, no one would have thought that the Equal Protection Clause would prevent voluntary efforts by school boards to promote integration. In fact, that happened a lot at the time of the passage of the 14th Amendment. So this idea that we're bound by some sort of, that conservatives are bound by text and history, well, that went out the wayside today. And it's, I think, certainly the plurality opinion and even the court's opinion generally that Justice Kennedy joined is going to have a big chilling effect on school boards across the country and other state and local entities that want to promote integration and to take measured steps to ameliorate
the role of
race in society.
Yeah, I get it. Just laying this out, Doug Kendall. I mean, what we have in the United States is an increasingly segregated society. We've been a variety of studies over the last 20 years showing that, particularly since the election of Ronald Reagan, since 1980, the society in America has become increasingly segregated. It's become largely segregated by class, by income, but because of the vestigial remnants and perhaps the ongoing reality of racism in our society, it's also segregated by race, in a very significant fashion. And it seems to me that the conservative proclamation that it is racist to try to integrate schools and things like that is really code for, we've got our nice white suburb here, our nice white upper middle class suburb, and we don't want any poor kids or black kids or Latino kids or, you know, whatever, coming into our school system. I mean, that's really, that's what this is all code for, and this decision is going to make it possible for those kind of communities and those kind of school districts to simply say that, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, Walter Dellinger in a piece he wrote for Slate this morning says, you know, the conservatives are under the impression that if they strike down all race-conscious measures, we'll go to this Garden of Eden where there'll be no racism or no division in this country based on race, and that's exactly the opposite of what...
Well, they're not under that impression. They're using that rhetoric, but
the reality is
that they're appealing to racism in the United States. They have been ever since Nixon started his Southern Strategy.
Well, they're certainly, I mean, the reality here is that what Seattle and Louisville are trying to do is ameliorate the residential segregation patterns that have been encouraged by prior decisions by state and local governments, by individuals over the course of the last 100 years that have resulted in residential patterns which are almost completely segregated, at least in big cities, and that result in segregated or de facto segregated schools in our big cities. There are statistics which show, you know, that the vast majority of African-American kids go to de facto segregated schools, and that's what these programs are designed to combat and to act as if race will become less of a factor in this country by striking down these laws just defies reality.
Is this generation's Dred Scott decision?
I don't think so, simply because it's not the worst parts of it are not joined by five justices.
Because it's you have the only four.
It's not a majority. There's not a majority of the court signed on to the reading of Brown and that the plurality would accept.
Interesting. A small point though, Doug. It's a subtle point. Let's say.
No,
Doug Kendall. Doug Kendall, communityrights.org for more information. The executive director, Doug. Thanks for being with us and sharing your insight into this. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
It's good to be king, just for a while. To be there in velvet, yeah, to give them a smile. It's good to get high, never come down. It's good to be king of your own little town.
Dick Cheney very much wants to be king. So this is the song that Dick Cheney wakes up to every morning. You know, the reality is though that there is a growing divide in America, and it's a divide that we need to acknowledge. From today's Wall Street Journal. The headline, New Alliance in Tax Bill Fight. Now, this seems to be kind of obscure, wonky stuff, and I'm telling you, it's not. This is the core. This is the Supreme Court decision that happened 2 days ago, in which the Supreme Court said that corporations can come in and give unlimited amounts of money to essentially political campaigns. They can't do it directly, but they can run ads. So about, quote, issues, end quote. So let's say we have a candidate like John Edwards, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Dennis Kucinich, whoever, running for president as a Democrat, who's saying we should have national health care. We should have, at the very least, the ability for everybody to buy into Medicare, which is the essence of John Edwards' program, for example, which is going to really hurt the profits of the healthcare industry. And the healthcare industry is making hundreds of billions of dollars. In profits, they could drop $1 billion into an election campaign and not even notice. Their stockholders wouldn't even notice it. And $1 billion is more than both Bush and Kerry spent in the entire 2004 election cycle. So they just come in and they just carpet bomb the airwaves with ads that say, don't vote for the Democrat, vote for the Republican, because the Republicans are the wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America. Or of, actually, it's not even corporate America anymore, of the worldwide corporate conspiracy. Now, part of this is that there is a separate, and this, you know, really the essence of our question for the day, should there be a completely separate tax system for the very wealthy? And the fact of the matter is that there is, and my take on it is that there shouldn't be, but the fact is that there is. And they want to keep it that way. And that's the essence of this article in today's Wall Street Journal. And again, as you know from our previous guest, this breaks out not just along super wealthy versus the merely wealthy and the middle class and everybody else, but it also breaks out along, by and large, race lines, because the vast majority of the ultra wealthy in the world are white males. There are obviously some exceptions, but that's the vast majority. So anyhow, as Congress considers raising taxes, this Brody Mullins piece in today's Wall Street Journal considers raising taxes on private equity and other financial firms. Now, let me just tell you what this is code for. Well, actually, they describe it. Brody Mullins describes it later in the article. The lobbyists aimed to kill a proposal requiring managers of certain private partnerships. These are these private equity firms. Requiring them to pay ordinary income tax rates as high as 35%. That's what you or I would pay, you know, as if our income went up into the range where we're paying the top income tax rate. Now, these are people whose incomes in some cases are over $1 billion a year. And so the article The lobbyists aim to kill a proposal that would raise taxes on wealthy investment managers by requiring managers of certain private partnerships to pay ordinary income tax rates of as much as 35% on the cut of profits, known as carried interest in industry parlance, which is now taxed at the 15% capital gains rate. In other words, these folks are paying a maximum right now of 15% income tax. And in fact, in the UK, you see this over at thisislondon.co.uk, only one in six of those earning more than $10 million a year is paying any income tax at all. Rupert Murdoch's corporation, News Corp, two of the last 4 years paid no income taxes at all, yet showed billions of dollars in profits. So here we have the rich and the super rich paying a maximum of 15% income tax because Bush changed the law so that if you make your living sitting around the pool, sitting on your butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail, you pay a maximum 15% income tax. And Congress is saying, the Democrats in Congress are saying, no, those guys should pay the same taxes as somebody who's out digging ditches for a living. And here's the story. More than from today's Wall Street Journal, more than 70 lobbyists in the financial services, real estate, and oil sectors met with lawmakers yesterday to launch the Coalition for the Freedom of American Investors and Retirees, an ad hoc group opposing higher taxes on investment income. By higher taxes, they're talking about normal taxes. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce will host a similar meeting for industry lobbyists to begin sharing information and plotting strategy. Henry Kravis, chief of private equity firm Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts, and Company, made the rounds to rally lawmakers against the so-called carried interest bill. He, of course, paying 15% income tax. Opponents of the legislation got a boost yesterday. The opponents of the legislation to raise these taxes, in other words, the people who want taxes on the rich to stay at 15%, got a boost yesterday when the Bush administration weighed in. Mr. Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, speaking at the Wall Street Journal's Deal and Dealmakers Conference at New York Stock Exchange, warned Congress against dealing with the issue on a piecemeal basis. White House spokesman Tony Snow said President Bush also opposes the effort to alter the tax rate. Meanwhile, there were 14 billionaires in the United States in 1985. There are now more than 1,000. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
5-1, baby. 1 in 5. No one here gets out alive now. You get yours, baby. I'll get mine. Gonna make it.
Our activism, we are the majority. So why is it that Senator Ben Cardin, the Democrat from Maryland, Sheldon Whitehouse, the Democrat from Rhode Island, Ron Wyden, the Democrat from Oregon, Harry Reid, the Democrat from Nevada, Claire McCaskill, the Democrat from Missouri, and Amy Klobuchar, the Democrat from Minnesota, that none of them support single payer? Well, actually, I'm not sure that we could absolutely say that. This op-ed piece over at Counterpunch. I've talked with Ron Wyden about this. I'm not sure that would be an absolute accurate statement. But SEIU held a rally, a couple of hundred healthcare workers on Capitol Hill, and these were the senators who showed up in support of helping our healthcare system, and it's a fine thing it is. By the way, head over to the airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page blog, and once again today, David is going to pick out his favorite post to our blog at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page, and it could be a funny one, it could be a serious one, whatever, and that person is going to receive an autographed copy of my newest book, Screw the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So blog with us over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. So anyhow, I just want to wrap this thing up. This, as I said, from today's Financial Times, there were 14 billionaires in the United States in 1985. This is, in the first couple of years of the Reagan administration. Today there are more than 1,000, and it's rising fast. This phenomenon is going on elsewhere in the world as well, in Latin America, the Middle East, and China, notes the Financial Times. At the same time, economic growth slows to 0.7% pace in first quarter, weakest in more than 4 years. This from the Associated Press. Even though the economy slowed in the first quarter and inflation gauge picked up speed, core prices rose at 2.4% in the first quarter. And by the way, that excludes food and energy, which are going up even faster than that. And at the same time, the World Millionaires Club is now 9.5 million people. There are the number of millionaires in the world increased by 8.3% in 2006, with 9.5 million individuals estimated to have a worth of more than $1 million. So that's $9.5 trillion if each one is only worth a million. But it's a whole heck of a lot more than that. It's actually $37.2 trillion because a lot of them are worth a lot more than $1 million. And the number of ultra-high net worth individuals, individuals with financial assets exceeding $30 million, increased by 11%. There are now 94,970 people in the world with a net worth of greater than $30 million. So really what we're seeing, and I think a lot of people are startled by how small that number actually is. Because there's this perception that, oh, there's a lot of really, really rich people in the world. No, there is a very small number. There are 6.5 billion people on the planet. And only 94,970 of them have a net worth exceeding $30 million. The distribution of wealth on this planet has become increasingly, since the election of Reagan, since the election of Maggie Thatcher, since the rise of conservatism, has been increasingly cleaved among the haves and the have-nots and along lines of race. And we're seeing in the Supreme Court decisions of 2 days ago, which said that those who aggregate wealth using the corporate form may have undue influence, inappropriate, in my opinion, excessive, wildly excessive influence in the political sphere. That's just fine with the conservative five majority on the court, the corporatist. You could argue the fascist five, maybe that's what I should call them, because, I mean, in the classic sense of the word, in the fascism being the merger of corporate and state interests, that's certainly what that decision did, was it said, you know, okay, corporations can come into the political process in an unlimited fashion and manipulate it. And it didn't just strike down McCain-Feingold, by the way. It struck down 200 years of precedent. So, the fascist five on the court saying, no problem, multinational corporations, transnational corporations, they can do whatever they want in the political arena. And, by the way, today, the court's saying, and, by the way, if you want to try to remediate some of these class and race distinctions that have been the result of hundreds of years, arguably thousands of years, of slavery and class distinction in our society, in our culture, you can't do that anymore based on race. Can't do it. Sorry. Sarah, Roswell, Georgia. Hey, Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hi, I've been holding for so long. I just want to say I love you. I love listening to you. I just wanted to say something about the integration decision by the Supreme Court and how I think it's really directly related to what you're talking about, the separation between the working poor, the minority areas, and the wealthy. But one really bad thing about this, the desegregation laws when they were instituted, my sister lives in Florida. She has 4 girls. The oldest one just became school aged last year, and she wanted to send her to school. But the way they do it is they send your child to school kind of by lottery, by like a whimsical decision. I don't know how they do it exactly, but it's by lottery. And her daughter was going to have to go to school. My niece is going to have to go to school about half an hour away to help desegregate a school in a fairly bad area. Right. And so she's going to have to be on the bus for half an hour. She didn't have any choice. There's no second thing, so it's like a 5-year-old, 6-year-old kid being bused half an hour away from home. She can't go to school in her local community. She can't, create like a community. You know, there's a whole community environment when you go to school like a few blocks from your house.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I understand, you know, we need to integrate a lot of these other areas that are really neglected and their school systems are very neglected. But, you know, I'm not so sure. My sister's forced to homeschool. You know, she's got homeschool, mm-hmm. all 4 girls.
Well, there's been a big flight, away from public schools. You're right. There, a lot of people have gone to homeschooling. A lot of people have gone to private schools as a consequence of desegregation.
Yeah, she can't afford private school, you know. Forget
right.
that.
Yeah.
But
yeah, there is a very real challenge to it. And yet, as a society, we have to face this. I mean, the one thing that the integration of our schools did was it forced people to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should be attending to these these to the ghettoization essentially of schools in poor areas, and in those poor areas they're not always racially divided, by the way. I mean, they're particularly in the Appalachians, but also in other parts of the United States you find that the poor areas are white, just as, you know, in fact there are more poor whites in the United States than there are poor blacks. And,
well, it's just really strange to me because I kind of wish that they would, you know, that there was more attention in these areas, you know, where they do become dangerous areas because people are resorting to, like, selling drugs, or there's more crime in those areas because there's less hope, there's less possibility, and then money's pulled from the schools, and it's a huge, huge problem. But I just feel so bad for my sister because she's got a homeschool, she pays her taxes, she does everything she's supposed to do, but she cannot utilize her local school system. You know, she doesn't want her daughter on the bus for half an hour, and you know, frankly, in an area that's really, really, you know, neglected. You know, but she's really socially conscious and she would like to be more involved, and, you know, she would like to be able to say, well, it's okay to send my little girl all the way over there.
Right. Well, it's a consequence of the continuing fracturing of our society ever since Reagan came in and started rolling back the not just the New Deal practices of Franklin Roosevelt, but also the Great Society practices of Lyndon Johnson. And the reason why people are selling drugs in the inner city isn't because African Americans, for example, are more disposed to take drugs. Actually, nicotine, one of the most widely used drugs in our society, more white teenagers. As a percentage, because there's more white teenagers than black teenagers, but white teenagers are more likely to smoke than black teenagers, for example.
Right.
White teenagers are more likely to abuse drugs than black teenagers. The reason why the drug abuse is highlighted in the African-American communities is because there's no other economic opportunity. Basically, what you see is people who are who are experiencing the consequence of racism, institutional racism, and they want to be entrepreneurs. I mean, that's a kind of a natural human instinct. And so, what are you going to be an entrepreneur around if everything that is normal and legal is blocked to you? Well, you do it with what's not normal and legal, which in this case would be drugs. But that's the problem. Is these larger societal issues that we stopped addressing in the 1980s have exacerbated the divide of race and class in this country, and now it's echoing down to our schools, and to deal with it, and you make a good point, Sarah, and I thank you very much for that. To deal with it just at the level of the schools is a mistake. We need to deal with it at a larger level, but this is symptomatic of that larger issue. John in Hayward, California. Hey, John.
I want to talk about the immigration decision. I see this as something that's well coordinated and used to divide this country, which it makes it easier.
You're talking about the Supreme Court decision on integration.
Right, and it makes it easier for us to keep us squabbling and offshore our jobs. I'll give you an example here. Back when they pretty much gutted the affirmative action thing here in California, I was wondering why, you know, they actually imported a bunch of right-wing talk show hosts to really whoop up the fever on this. And I suddenly realized that once that was defeated, that there were no Americans that corporations had to hire, and our jobs actually started to be offshored even more. That was like the last impediment to stop offshoring our jobs. And a lot of this is really tough on the level that you have a lot of blacks that are getting straight A's in school and whatnot, and this is never highlighted. In fact,
no, you're absolutely right, John. And as long as we have large pockets of poverty in the United States, the whole idea of offshoring jobs, or for that matter, increasing the level of immigration, is crazy. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Blame it on the snow. Blame it on the snow. Oh, yeah. No doubt about it. That's what Crazy O'Reilly would do. Blame everything on the Rolling Stones. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Speaking of crazy, crazy alert here. Indeed, all kinds of strange things happening out there. Wayward kitty, an Illinois mechanic, finds a van just purring under the hood. So mechanic Scott Bella, who works in an auto service shop in the south suburb of Chicago, thought he heard a cat's meow coming from a customer's van he was driving Tuesday. Yes, the woman who had a cat in her van, she looked at him like he was crazy, so he pulls the hood up, and sure enough, there's a cat sitting there. Same thing happened to me, by the way. We had a Maine Coon cat, Java, in Vermont. I drove like 60 miles. I had no idea this cat was under my hood. And over to Burlington, I was giving a talk or a book signing one night, and we were stopped at some friends' houses. And I got out of the car, and he says, meow, 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 under the hood. I lift up the hood of the car, and there's my cat. We have several cats. This is not Higgins. This is another one, Java. Sitting on the battery, you know, like trying to keep away from the heat of the motor. And so I took him into the house, and he looked like a wreck. I mean, he was just all covered with grease and grime and everything else. And here's the really weird part about it. The friend that we were visiting, his brother-in-law was there, who was a veterinarian. And I had to go give a speech in 10 minutes. And so I was able to hand my cat, who had, you know, for the last hour been under the hood of my car, to a veterinarian. And he rehydrated him, and he was just fine when I came back. So anyhow, that's a crazy alert for today. Here's another one. Mitt Romney's been called many things when he runs for president. Chances are sticky rice isn't one of them. This is from the Associated Press. That's how his name may read on some ballots, however. This out of Boston from according to Secretary of State William Galvin. He says, Federal Justice Department is pressuring Boston election officials to translate candidates' names into Chinese characters into precincts with prominent Chinese-speaking populations. It's a little lost in the translation. There's no Chinese character for Romney, so it comes out as sticky rice. Fred Thompson will come out as virtue soup. On the other hand, Barack Obama comes out bus horse. So, you know, it's, And the mayor of Boston, Thomas Menino, his name could be Sun Moon Rainbow Farmer, or it could be Barbarian Mud No Mind of His Own. So it's I have a feeling this, you know, translation into Chinese is going to end up being a rather political thing. And finally, Bob Rowe, one of my early mentors in this business, he said, if you're going to do talk radio, always bring a chainsaw to a knife fight. Well, sure enough, a guy actually did it. I mean, we try to do it metaphorically here on the radio, but police speculate a man may have felt outnumbered when a drumheller bar fight spilled into the streets and tried to defend himself by waving around a running chainsaw. This is from Sun Media. In my 10 years as a police officer, this is the first time I've ever been called to a bar fight with a chainsaw, said Corporal Mark Harrison of the Drumheller RCMP. This was in Canada. Cops were called to a street fight that spawned from a skirmish outside the Octane nightclub around 2:30 a.m. Friday. Harrison says it appears that a 25-year-old grabbed the chainsaw from a bed of a nearby pickup truck, pulled the cord, got the thing started, and brandished it to repel a group of attackers. Yeah, that's the way to do it. I'm telling you, if you're going to be in a knife fight, whip out a chainsaw. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Lee in Boulder, Colorado, you're on the air. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I really want to applaud you for everything that you're doing here, and I've really enjoyed your shows, especially the last few days when you've been talking a lot about the multinational corporations and taxation and what's happening in this country. And I just wanted to hear you comment on, I know you've talked about him, Aaron Russo, and he's got a great website, freedomtofascism.com. And he originally started talking about the 16th Amendment, which was never ratified. There is no legal law that says that there is unapportioned tax on private labor. However, there right. is tax on corporations. And as he goes down the rabbit hole on his website, he talks about the Federal Reserve System, what's happening with the central banks, the one world government, and it seems that it's the tip of the iceberg for everything that is being talked about these days or not talked about by the media.
I've seen Aaron Russo's movie. I got it, Lee. I've seen Aaron Russo's movie. I've been to his website, and I've interviewed him on this program and talked with him off the air as well. And here's my take on it. In the last part of his movie, Freedom to Fascism, Aaron Russo correctly identifies a whole lot of very serious problems. The first half of his movie, he's really done two movies. He's done the first half of his movie is basically the libertarian line that, you know, this is a terrible thing that the Fed exists. And well, it's not just the libertarian line. It's sort of this whole thing. And I may be inclined to agree with him, but he's taking it to a level that, you know, we don't have to. The largest part of it is there is no legal basis for the income tax. I don't have to pay no stinking taxes. And, you know, this of course, as I said, the libertarian line and the Grover Norquist, the uber Republican line. And I just I don't want to go there. It's, you know, it's the 16th Amendment, whether or not it was ultimately ratified by the final state, you know, maybe that should be revisited. I don't know. Is it legal or not? The fact of the matter is, here it is. And whether or not, and it's also, frankly, I think, you know, a tax on income is one of the most progressive ways to tax people in society. I mean, the fact of the matter is we do have all of these things that are part of the infrastructure of our country that we want to have. Schools and police and fire departments and roads and all these other things. And there's a whole variety of taxes for them. Schools are largely funded with property taxes. Roads are largely funded with gasoline taxes. Our police and fire are largely funded with, actually in many cases, with property taxes. But there's a lot of our infrastructure that is funded with income tax. And income tax is one of the fairest, frankly, ways to do it, because as Teddy Roosevelt pointed out, those who benefit the most from the infrastructure of society, from our court system, from our economic system, from our financial system, should pay the most. I mean, you know, they should pay in proportion to their benefit. And so progressive income tax is a healthy and reasonable thing. And I think that Aaron Russo just, you know, drank the Kool-Aid in the first half of that movie. And that was, frankly, a shame. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Now, here's an interesting one. Every now and then, welcome back to the program, by the way. Every now and then, somebody will make a comment in the chat room, and I'm going, huh? Tromper, he says, I'd like someone to ask Ron Paul about never making it past junior varsity for his shotgun club. I have a feeling there's a story there, and maybe Tromper will share it with us one of these days. The left-wing Center for Science and the Public Interest. I'm reading, by the way, from a news release from the right-wing businessandmedia.org, the Business and Media Institute. The left-wing Center for Science and the Public Interest, a radically liberal food police group that supports anti-industry regulation and is misleadingly labeled a consumer advocacy group by the media, may have effectively killed off a number of Kellogg's characters after threatening a lawsuit for marketing to children. In fact, David McKay, the president and chief executive officer of Kellogg Corporation, a company I should probably toss in the caveat, used to be a client of mine when I owned an ad agency many years ago, said, we are pleased to work collaboratively with industry and advocacy groups to unveil these standards. We feel the Kellogg Nutrient Criteria set a new standard for responsibility in the industry. They seem to like this. But really, the larger question here is, does society have the right to protect its children from predatory corporations? Dan Gaynor is with us. He's the director of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org. I'm assuming, Dan, you wrote that news release I was reading a little earlier.
I had. That would be fair to say I had a hand in that. Yes, indeed.
Okay. And would it be fair to say that your position is that society does not have the right to protect its children from predatory corporations?
See, of course, the way you spin that makes it sound like, oh, we've got to save the children. It sounds like a line from South Park. You know, let's be honest here. This is not what they're doing. This is an extremist group has more interest in their own agenda than protecting anybody's children.
And what's their agenda?
Their agenda is they want to control every aspect of our lives. This is a group that this year has come out against Chinese food, casual dining, wholesale produce markets, caffeine, kids' cafeteria food, some sort of cooked product called Inviga, advertising to children, wine, and
actually, they have not come out against any of those things. What they have done is, in every single one of those cases, they have pointed out areas where you should know that, for example, Chinese food is much higher in fat than you thought. The caffeine may have a downside that you didn't know about. I mean, this is simply a consumer advocacy group.
I
would think that as an advocate of the free market, you would want a group like this out here helping people in the so-called free market to be educated about what their choices are.
They're not advocating for choices. They're advocating for mandates, for government regulation to force companies to do things. I mean, in the case with Kellogg's, it wasn't that Kellogg's was happy about this. What happened is they sued Kellogg's, and Kellogg's chose the path of least resistance to avoid ending up in one of these, you know, hell holes of, you know, legal jurisprudence somewhere where they're going to get, you know, hammered for $100 million or billion-dollar verdict for selling something we
all want
to buy.
Kellogg's is a billion-dollar corporation. The Center for Science and the Public Interest is a tiny nonprofit.
Well, it's not that
if
tiny.
This,
it's pretty large.
If this lawsuit had no merit whatsoever, Kellogg's would have eaten them for lunch, no pun intended.
But you know that the reality of the court system is no lawsuit is ever thrown out because it has no merit. It ends up in a jury. You don't know what a jury will do. Business is all about certainty.
Not true, Dan. The vast majority of frivolous cases, and I'd say by vast majority, I mean well over 99%. This is very well documented by people on the left and on the right, by the way, of frivolous lawsuits. Even when juries make stupid decisions, they get overturned on appeal.
But, of course, then you end up spending millions of dollars and getting hammered, remember, hammered in the media. The media, which is openly in support of a lot of these crazy CSPI things.
But this isn't the legislature doing something that you're so concerned about. This is a private group suing another private group, a nonprofit suing a corporation out there in the public arena saying, hey, wait a minute, you're behaving in a way that's not good for our kids, and the corporation says, you know, I guess you're right. We're gonna change our behavior. I don't understand why you'd be opposed to that.
Look at how CBS handled this. You've got Hannah Storm coming out saying, well, that's a great idea. You know, and then, of course, Hannah Storm going off basically talking
well,
about...
Well, that's what Kellogg said.
But it's not the... First of all, it's not the journalism. Journalists decide whether it's a great idea or not. And this is a parental responsibility issue, not some outside group coming in and telling parents how they should handle their kids and forcing them to, you know, saying, well, you can't do this, you can't do that.
So parents should go to the food factory and inspect the assembly line. They should know where all the ingredients are sourced from. They should go to China and find out which factories are producing poisonous stuff that's not labeled and which aren't.
There's already tons of information out there for parents. I mean, they're going out here
but
talking about advertising
like this
to children.
That you're attacking.
They're talking about advertising to children, saying we don't want you advertising to children. They're not saying the federal government does, saying CISPE doesn't want you advertising to children. When I was growing up, my parents had a policy. If they didn't want me to do something, or if I was in a store and I was asking for a product that they didn't want me to have, they used this real big parental thing called the word no. And if I asked again, no had additional exclamation points, and I didn't ask a third time. I mean, that's what they are trying to be, the parents for all America here. That's what CISPE's trying
to
do.
They're not trying to be the parents. They're trying to stick up for the parents. The reality is, Dan, and speaking as the parent of three now grown children, I can tell you, going up against a multi-billion-dollar industry as a parent, as just, you know, just Louise and I here trying to tell our kids, yeah, I know Joe Camel makes it look cool to smoke, or no, yeah, I know Toucan Sam says, you know, you should eat your Cocoa Puffs or whatever it is. Going up against a multi-billion-dollar industry, and there's a reason why billions of dollars are spent on advertising, because it does persuade, and I can tell you that from personal experience. As I said, I worked in that industry for a lot of years, and including for Kellogg's, it's done because it works, and it works, frankly, ultimately, to the detriment of our children. It's one of the reasons, back in the 70s, I got out of that business. At what point are you suggesting that we should not be able to say to corporations, sorry, you cannot advertise, you cannot target our children with ads, particularly for products that are not in their interest?
But what
they're
not
going to do them.
If you go by the CISPE,
you have an epidemic of childhood obesity in this country.
If you go by the CISPE definition of what's not in their interest, it's pretty much everything but, you know, tofu. I mean, you know, we're talking about.
Oh, come on, Dan. That's hyperbole. You know it.
You know, you heard the list. I mean, they don't like, and they have come out and criticized or complained or critiqued all the products that are listed and a whole bunch more. They are food extremists, anti-industry extremists. And I don't want them trying to pick my meal or the meal of my family, trying to come out and say, here's what you should eat because it's CISPE approved. If we go by
they're not
that,
trying
we'll
to pick
starve.
Your meal. They're not trying to pick your meal. They're informing people about what's going on, and they're standing up for
parents.
If they were
just informing, they would simply be trying to do that. Instead, no, they are trying to litigate against companies to mandate rules and regulations they can't get through the legislature, so they're trying to legislate via courts. They and several other organizations are consciously trying to say that food is the new tobacco. I mean, this is not my term. That's their organization's term. They're part of an annual conference, annual or every other year, I'm not sure which, conference where they get together a bunch of...
Because millions of Americans are dying as a consequence of their food choices. Food is the new tobacco.
Millions of Americans would be dying if they didn't have food choices, too.
I would say processed food is the new tobacco, because processed food isn't even food. It's a new substance. It's stuff that will sit on a shelf for years at a time. Even rats won't eat it.
More, better... and just more diverse choices on food than any time in history. People live
right, and many of them are toxic to us.
But what may be toxic to you might not be toxic to me. What may be,
I'm not talking about food allergies here. I'm talking about things like trans fats and high fat levels and high sodium levels.
You remember? You know why we have trans fats in the system? Because groups
because
like
it's 50, cheap.
Groups like CISPE came out after polyunsaturated fats years ago. And then they came out and said, you've got to ban those. So now we have trans fats. Now they say you have to ban those.
Well, because industry went to the next cheapest thing that they could do.
But it's a constant game of whack-a-mole. You're never doing anything that these groups...
It's a constant game of improvement. It's a constant game of improvement. And the improvement wouldn't be happening if you didn't have groups like Center for the Science and the Public Interest out there raising these issues.
Companies to do something, if they just wanted to encourage or educate families is one thing. When they start litigating and legislating via the courts, then they are operating against the best interests of all of us. And I don't want them making the decision for my family. I want them making the decision for their own family. That's what personal responsibility is about.
So you'd rather have Kellogg's making the decision for your family?
No, because if Kellogg's is making the decision, I'm still making the decision for my own family.
I see. Okay. All righty. Dan Gaynor, the businessandmedia.org, the director of the Business and Media Institute. Dan, always good mixing it up with you. Thank you.
It is absolutely a fun time, Don. Take care.
16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program here on Air America Radio. Interesting. Who do you want making decisions for your kids?
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartmann program on Air America Radio.
You know I love that organic cooking. I always ask for more. And they call me Mr. Natural on down to the health food store. I only eat good sea salt. White sugar don't touch my lips. And my friends is always begging me to take them on macrobiotic trips. Yes, they are. Oh, but night I take out my strong box that I keep under lock and key. And I take it off to my closet where nobody else can see. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south. Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth. Yeah, in the daytime I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me.
But just don't let anybody know. Ever since he first started practicing, Berkeley, California psychologist, this is an article by Rebecca Clay. Advertising to children, is it ethical? Ever since he first started practicing, Berkeley, California psychologist Alan D. Kaner, Ph.D., had been asking his younger clients what they wanted to do when they grew up. The answer used to be nurse, astronaut, or some other occupation with intrinsic appeal. Today, the answer is more likely to be make money. For Kaner, one explanation for that shift can be found in advertising. She calls this the narcissistic wounding of children. Thanks to advertising, she says, children have become convinced that they are inferior as persons if they don't have an endless array of new products. And I'd say that there's a lot of truth to that. The message of advertising, ultimately, well, arguably there's three kinds of advertising. There's advertising that makes people just broadly aware of things, brand advertising. Hey, here we are. And then there's advertising that directly, and this, frankly, is the kind of advertising that most of my life I've been involved with, direct response advertising. Advertising that says, we have a product, And here's why, you know, here's what's good about this product, you know, why you should consider buying it. And it says, and if you need this, here's, you know, here's the product for you. Okay. And you talk about features and benefits and try to find your target market. You know, this is traditional advertising. But there's a third type of advertising that is very subtle and very powerful and is done at the highest levels by some of the largest corporations, particularly with the large consumer products, like junk foods to kids, fast foods to kids, tobacco and alcohol to young adults. And that kind of advertising actually operates on a psychological level rather than a practical level, rather than a pure communication level. And that psychological level is very simple. The first message is, you are the most important person in the world. You are the center of the world, which is essentially a how to be a sociopath message. It is a, you know, as Rebecca Clay says, a narcissistic wounding, particularly when it goes to young people. Because functional societies understand that each one of us is not the center of the universe, that we are collectively part of a society. So advertising, first of all, promotes that, frankly, conservative worldview notion that we're all individuals and we're all alone and it's every man for himself and get what you can and get all you can and, you know, live, eat, drink, and be happy for tomorrow we may be dead. That kind of perspective, number one. And number two, because you're the most important person in the world, you have to be the best, and you're not. That's the subtle message. Or, in fact, let me take that out of the second person. The way that advertising communicates that message to kids in particular is to tell them that they are not complete, that they are not whole. The message of psychology-driven advertising is to tell particularly children and young adults that they are not whole and complete people. Although this is, you know, it also works with full-blown adults. I mean, you see things like, you know, the tooth whitening craze, or is your hair too gray, or, you know, Botox, or, you know, whatever. I mean, right across the board. Telling people that they're not complete without this product, that they're not good enough without this product, that they're not going to be able to compete socially without this product, that they're not going to be socially accepted without this product. Redefining the norms of social acceptance, redefining what it is to be a member of society. This kind of advertising, you know, Vance Packard, his book The Hidden Persuaders back in the 60s, took a shot at this, although, you know, everybody was paying attention mostly to his talking about subliminal advertising, which was a good chunk of his book. But it was the first real serious exposure of this kind of advertising, of the deep roots of psychology in that kind of advertising. And when that kind of advertising is directed at children or at adolescents, or frankly, even at adults, at that level, at a psychological level, at a level that challenges a person's sense of self, as opposed to simply saying, oh, you have a need, we have a product. You want to buy a car? We've got the best car. Crash tests show that our car will, you know, you're more likely to survive if you're in an accident in our car. There's good reason to buy it. That's straightforward advertising. But to say, but to suggest to a person that they are not a complete person, that they're not a real man, for example, if they don't have this particular type of car, or that they're not a real woman if they don't have this particular, or that they're not going to be accepted if their teeth aren't a particular way. That's a whole different thing. That's at the level of psychology. And I think, frankly, as a society, we should be, A, sensitizing our kids and all the rest of us to this, and B, we should be having a discussion about the ethics of this, the practical and appropriate ethics of this kind of advertising. 27 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Now, Daddy didn't like trouble, but if it came along, everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on. He never was a hero for this county's shining light, but you could always find him standing up what he thought was right. He'd say, you've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything. You've got to be your
indeed
own man.
Not a It reminds me of a story from my own childhood. About my dad. I opened my book Screwed with a story of my father who died last June. And when I was a teenager, one of our neighbors, one of the kids in our neighborhood, a girl in our neighborhood, a white girl in our neighborhood, was going to marry a black man, and her father refused to go to the marriage, to the wedding. And this created quite a rift in the neighborhood. My dad gave her away. He went to the wedding, and he walked up the aisle with her, because her own father would not go to her wedding. And it's just an extraordinary thing. You have to stand for something. You really do. By the way, head over to airamerica.com/TomHartmanpage and join the blog and start blogging. Could you put you in the running for our daily giveaway at the end of the show? David Poole, our producer, pardon me, I'm running on Robitussin here, in his own inimitable fashion, is going to pick his favorite blog entry for the day and share it with us. 1-866-303-2270, and that person will receive a free copy of my new book. It's out in paperback just now, actually. Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And I think it's one of the better books that I've written. Chad in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hey, Chad, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing? I just want to say, first of all, I'd like to say I do appreciate people like Dan Gaynor who perceive an injustice. And, you know, they're out there trying to do something about it. But if you're going to shake your stick at something, why these nonprofit watchdogs that are doing things that I think government is meant to do?
Because you're running a think tank that's funded by big corporations.
And, you know, if I want my money to go, especially these days, you know, I don't know where my tax money's going, and it'd probably be difficult to find out at this point if I wanted to find out, but, you know, I want them going to places. Like you said, I'm not going to go to China and investigate the cereal I'm eating and things like that. That's what they're there for. And you know, it's a question of motivation for me. It doesn't seem like a get-rich-quick scheme that these nonprofit watchdogs are doing here. You know, there's a lot of effort and time, as I imagine Mr. Gaynor does. You know, I want to give him credit for the fact that he sees something and wants to do something about it. But boy, I can think of a bunch of other things he could be forwarding his efforts for.
Yeah, Dan's a pretty articulate guy. It would be nice if he would make the change and come over to our side, but. Time will tell. Maybe we can, you know, we'll keep working on him. Chad, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Rick in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, please forgive me because I called a couple days ago. The guy that you had on, like, this guy talking about the cereal, mm-hmm. It's like a subtext of the family guy you had on 2 days ago or yesterday. He's pro-family. As a head of my household, I should be able to judge this, that, and the other.
This is the conservative worldview, is that we as individuals stand alone and that there is no social contract. It's the, you know, the main libertarian argument is that there is no social contract.
I have a question for
ahead.
You.
Sure.
Well, let me ask you this. You, now, he's a recurring guest, right?
Well, Dan's on with someone.
Or when you have someone on like that, ask them, you know, who is pro-family and supported by, you know, think tanks supported by corporations, large corporations. Ask them what they think about, for example, the Public Utility Holding Companies Act being repealed, the weakening of the EPA. Ask them what they think about that.
Well, I can tell you right now, I'm not going to try and speak for Dan Gaynor, but I can tell you that the conservative perspective on that is that that's just fine. Their opinion is that corporations should run the world.
Then how can they legitimize their argument if they're talking about pro-family when, in actuality, everything that's happening around us is weakening the relationships between men and women?
Because they're utopianists. They believe that they're believing this weird conservative philosophy, which has never, by the way, successfully been played out in any society,
right,
that
exactly.
If you simply hand over all the power to the corporations, to the so-called free market, that somehow everything will balance out and the public interest, you know, enlightened self-interest, Ayn Rand's great phrase, enlightened self-interest will ultimately rule the day and everything will work out. And it's wrong. But Rick, you're good job of pointing it out. Thank you very much. Paul in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPRO.
Hey, Tom. Heard you talking about, you know, the cereal and the marketing and stuff. And about the soy industry. Does everybody really know all the negative things about soy? You're
talking about uncooked soybean toxic, or the associations between soy and dementia? Yeah.
You know, soy is like right from the garden there. It's the highest in aluminum. You know, they say 250,000 people come down with Alzheimer's. You know, they still have fertilizers. Used to use it in the 50s and 60s for roses, and it was a dust. And it was, you know, the ingredients. Some Nobel Prize winner said that there was a connection with that, with Alzheimer's. But, you know, because back then they used it a lot for their, you know, they grew gardens and stuff. And,
yeah, I have a friend back in Michigan who runs the Creative Health Institute, Don Hoy, who is very into this thing. At first I thought it was kind of a fringe theory that soy is somehow associated with dementia, because I mean you've got entire societies. I mean, look at all the tofu that they eat in Asia, for example, that consume large quantities of soy, and they don't seem to be particularly demented. But the fertilizer link to it and the aluminum link to it, interesting. You got me thinking about it. I don't know. Anyhow, Roger in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Roger, what's up?
Oh, first of all, on the soy thing, there's an article in the current Utney Reader that shows the pros and cons. I haven't read it yet, but I just picked it up.
Oh, interesting. I've got that floating around here. Carl was offering it to me this morning. I'll have to track it down.
What I was referring to was the advertising and marketing, and I think that in an ideal world, we would be somehow teaching kids from the very youngest to separate marketing and advertising from reality. It's so out of control, and I know that it's a free market, supposedly, but these products are not free, and they're taking everyone's money and getting control of families and kids and everyone in one way or another through marketing.
And the conservatives say, but you should just be able to say no to your child.
It's not a fair fight. It's not a fair fight because the adults are setting a bad example because they're swayed by the credit card debt. And once that happens, they don't have freedom anymore. Then they are completely on the leash of the big corporations.
There's that too. But I think ultimately it's the chain fight, the chainsaw coming to the knife fight. It's like the parents are trying to have the knife fight and the corporations come in with a chainsaw. And you just can't compete with a $1 billion corporation for the mind of your kid. I mean, you can try. And a lot of us valiantly did and do, but you can compete, but it's a very, 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 very difficult competition.
Once again, it's about parenting, and people who really, really respect parenting should think twice about it and not.
Yeah,
push
but it's
anybody.
Not. But I'd say beyond that, Roger, it's not just about parenting. It's about ultimately the question is: does society have the right to protect itself from corporate predators? To protect its children from corporate predators? And when it's put in those terms, the answer has to be an absolute yes. And this is where the conservatives are going. Oh no, if it's a corporation, it's not a predator. No, corporations are not designed to serve the interests of society. They're designed to serve the interests of profit. And if profit hurts children, that's no problem for a corporation. If you end up with an epidemic of obesity in the United States, no problem. As long as there's not specific corporate liability, the corporation, in fact, is required by law to try and pursue that. And that's where the corporation is sociopath is something that I think is fundamentally destructive to America.
The fact, the one good thing that has come out of raising awareness of obesity and credit card debt is that those are two very large things that the conservatives would have, you know, in a debate, would have a lot of problem, I think, arguing with. There's
what they do is they try to make it, again, just like with the immigration debate, it's all about illegal immigrants. I'm sorry, it's all about illegal corporations, illegal employers. They try to make it about bad people rather than bad institutions or bad laws, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
They try to make it always about, you know, blame the victim, blame the individual. But, you know, good point, Roger. Thank you for the call. Eddie in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Eddie, what's up?
Hey, talking about marketing, you know, for kids and adults and you must have and everything. Did you know that whenever you buy shampoos that are for fine hair or oily hair or normal hair, that the only difference is the chemicals they put in the shampoos that make the suds. So one will lather more, one will lather less, but neither one helps your oily hair or your normal hair or whatever. It's just the amount of suds that is created.
Yeah, it could be. My guess is that there are those kinds of areas where people ultimately figure out what works best for them. You know, and consumer products is probably a big one, where this product works well for me, this product doesn't. What I'm concerned about, though, is what if there's an ingredient in that product that if it's absorbed through my scalp, it's going to cause cancer? There's no way that I am going to have a lab in my house and, 15 generations of lab rats to find out, or petri dishes and human cell tissue cultures to find out that ingredient is going to cause cancer. That's what I want people to be telling me about. That's what I want my government to be doing. I want them to be looking into the possibility that that product is dangerous. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Can't you see the fence where I should be? I'm a poor heartache with each of your mistakes. Cause you move.
Yeah, Ben Bernanke, we're all going to be watching you. By the way, just to put a fine point on the end of our last conversation, in the United States this year, advertisers will spend $230 billion. That's $2,180 per household. Not an insignificant amount. Plus, we have an update on robot pigeons from the planet Xenon. This an email from Patricia. I don't know if she wants her last name said, so I'll just say Patricia. She says, I found a pigeon with a broken wing and took pity and brought him in and put him in a cage on the porch to take care of him. Sadly, I told a colleague of it, and his son also found a pigeon with a broken wing and gave him to me also. Well, it turned out one was a male and one was a female, apparently, and this is where the plot thickens. I had two pigeons, and then I had two pigeons and three eggs. No courtship at all either, by the way. And then I had five pigeons, and I never saw a baby pigeon either. They went directly to full grown. How did it happen? I let the flying pigeons go, and it happened again. Three more eggs went directly to five full-grown freaky spy pigeons. I don't know how they do that. I let the flyers go, and then I sneaked these broken spy pigeons into the local zoo. It was all very scary. Thank you, Patricia, for confirming my theory here. Pigeons are robots in the planet Xenon. It's a plot. See, if Tom Cruise, if they can create a religion around this, I can create a religion around pigeons, right? Victoria Jones, what do you think?
I agree.
You agree? Haven't you noticed, Victoria, by the way, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, haven't you noticed that wherever there are world leaders, wherever there are VIPs, wherever really important decisions are being made, there are pigeons spying on them?
There always
think about
are.
It. There always are, yeah. The mothership comes out every 6 months or once a year and drops a whole brand new load of spy pigeons. They're robotic pigeons, and they follow us all around and they're spying on us. And then they upload them and download
the
information.
Take them away again.
That's right, and that's why you never see baby pigeons and you never see dead pigeons because they're all robots.
I've never seen one.
Yep, there you go.
And I lived in London, and we have Trafalgar Square there.
Yeah, which is Pigeon Central.
Exactly.
Because
that's where they all emanate from.
Because that's probably where the mothership drops them off. Yeah. Anyhow, what's happening in Washington, D.C., Victoria?
Well, I mean, all kinds of things. First of all, some very good news, which is that, as you know, we were all booted. The press was booted out of its rather dingy digs in the basement of the White House several months ago, and we were told that it was going to be renovated, and we were promised, including by the president at the podium at a press briefing, that we would be allowed back in, and we were shuffled over to another briefing center, and we didn't believe the president because we didn't think he had a terribly good track record. And anyway, as of today, we're moving back in, and cynics are saying, not I, but some cynics are saying that this is the first promise that the White House administration has kept.
And I'll tell you why.
Go on.
It's because the reason that they shuffled you out was so that they could install the spy cameras and the microphones.
They were already in.
Oh, really?
Oh, absolutely. People already believe that they were bugged. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. The press office is being bugged. And why is it that increasingly in America we're starting to, talk to each other the way that people in the Soviet Union and East Berlin, East Germany used to talk to each other. I mean, it's like, we know they're listening. We know they're listening. I mean, it's
well,
really...
I think because of our cell phones, I mean, and GPS, and we know that they can target us, and they know exactly where we are if our cell phones are on.
Right. Now, here's something that's interesting. The New York Times, it was either the New York Times or the Washington Post, in a story about the Bush illegal wiretapping operation, made the assertion that there is no evidence that Bush was illegally wiretapping political opponents. But the fact of the matter is that there's no evidence that Bush wasn't illegally wiretapping political opponents either. The fact of the matter is there's no evidence at all, period, because the Bush administration has not provided any. Why would the mainstream media try to spin this to make it look like this is not a Watergate-style wiretapping operation, when in fact it may well be?
It's a very interesting question. I would tend to think that that came out of the Washington Post rather than the New York Times.
Yeah.
A statement like that.
I could track it down. I read it this morning, it's
yeah,
popped
I read
out of my
it
brain
too,
now.
And I can't remember which one it was because I read both the articles in both. I don't know why the mainstream media would do that. An excess of caution. They're so terrified of being called liberal these days that they go to excessive extents to try to appear the other way.
Yeah, interesting. Any fallout or response in Washington? Do you think Congress is going to do anything as a consequence of any of these Supreme Court decisions that we've seen recently today? Affirmative action, or what may end up affecting affirmative action yesterday, the day before corporations can flip political elections, things like that?
I actually haven't been following the Supreme Court decisions, to be honest with you, so I don't know the answer to that. I'm closer to the subpoenas.
Ah, so and is my guess that the White House is simply going to try and play the clock out until the end of the Bush administration, another 571 days, 10 hours, 58 minutes, and 30 seconds? You think that's going to?
You've
that's
got
how
that special clock, haven't you? Well, Fred Fielding,
I do.
The White House Counsel, is exerting executive privilege with regard to some subpoena requests, which are for documents, and four of them are due today, and one of them's due on July the 12th. So they're exerting executive privilege on those document requests. That doesn't impact the subpoena request that we had yesterday, but I think that we can extrapolate from that it's very likely going to. So
are these today the ones that are due today? Are they going to go to court? Is that what happens next?
Basically, it'll go to court. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, keep us up to date on it.
Will do.
Thank you. Thank you, Victoria Jones, of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Great talking with you, Victoria. 57 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, this is very interesting. Welcome back, by the way, to the third hour of our program. Last night, Jonathan Turley, over on MSNBC's Countdown program, Keith Olbermann's show, I watched this last night. I thought, he's saying what I have been saying for, 2 years now? That and frankly, what Judge Anna Diggs Taylor said, you know, in her ruling, and others have said, that George W. Bush broke the law in the spy case, in the case of spying on American citizens, the illegal wiretap operation. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act says that you may not wiretap people without a court order, and the reason it says that is because the United States Constitution has this small attachment to it called the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. Right? In other words, you have to demonstrate that there's some reason why you're going to invade somebody's house and go through their papers. And that probable cause must be supported by oath or affirmation. In other words, somebody has to swear that it's true. And particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. So, in other words, you cannot invade the privacy of a person or their papers or their home, and by extension, their electronic communications these days, telephone communications, without a court order, without a warrant. And that warrant has to be based on probable cause. Well, Bush, not only the Bush administration, with apparently much Republican support, not only invaded the privacy of Americans right across the board. This is what we were talking very just briefly, part of our conversation with Victoria Jones in the last hour about. Not only invaded our privacy, but Bush then, when it came out that he had done it, bragged about it. I mean, this is the classic Karl Rove strategy. You're taking your strength and making it a weakness, taking your opponent's taking your weakness and making it a strength, and taking your opponent's strength and making it a weakness. So here's Bush's weakness. He committed a crime. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act says that anybody who wiretaps people without a warrant in the United States, any executive, any administrator, any federal officer, actually the phrase in the law is federal officer, any federal officer, which would include the President of the United States, any federal officer who breaks this law, which says that you have to go through the FISA court before you can wiretap somebody. And the FISA court is virtually a rubber stamp. I mean, you can wiretap somebody for 3 days before you have to go back to the court to ask for retroactive permission. But nonetheless, you have to do it. There has to be at least some appearance of conforming with the Fourth Amendment. So Bush broke this law. And this law says that any federal officer who breaks this law shall be subject to 2 years in prison. It's a felony. We're not talking a traffic ticket here, and we're not talking about, I don't know if lying under oath before a grand jury. I'm pretty sure, you know, what Bill Clinton was impeached for. I think that that was a felony as well. I don't think that that was a high misdemeanor. But in any case, this is a major felony. We're talking a major felony, and that Bush did it thousands of times and that he involved hundreds of people in the conspiracy to do it. He required them to do it. And Alan Dershowitz last night, in response to, it was on Keith Olbermann's show, I think the only news show on television right now that's actually showing the news, Countdown with Keith Olbermann on MSNBC. I have even despaired of what's going on public broadcasting. 6 years of Bush rule, public broadcasting isn't what it used to be now that the Board of Governors is run by conservatives and whatnot. And you look at the guests that they have on, but in any case, that's a whole other rant. In that discussion, Jonathan Turley, who was a professor of law, Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University and a constitutional scholar, says, well, here's the clip.
Is move incredibly slowly. This president doesn't have long to go. But there is one thing that might concern them about the court.
Now, let me just toss this in. Keith Olbermann had just asked the question, might these guys just try to run out the clock? In other words, might they just try to say, okay, you've issued the subpoena, we're going to fight that, and we're going to go to court and fight it, and we're going to claim executive privilege, which is what Victoria Jones in our last segment just said, Fred Fielding this morning said, executive privilege. You know, there were papers that were supposed to be submitted to Congress today, and the Bush administration is refusing to submit them, and they're claiming executive privilege. Okay, so anyhow, here we are, Jonathan Turley.
And that is, you know, for many years since we first found out about this program, some of us have said that this was a clearly criminal act that the president called for, that under federal law, it's a federal crime to do what the president ordered hundreds of people to do. Now, if we're right, not only did he order that crime, but it would be, in fact, an impeachable offense. Now, both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, have avoided this sort of pig in the parlor. They don't want to recognize that this president may have ordered criminal offenses, but they may now be on the road to do that, because the way Congress can get around the executive privilege in court is to say we're investigating a potential crime. And if they do it here, that crime was ordered by no one other than George Bush.
And that's the essence of it. I mean, this is extraordinary, as they note over at the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org. As Columbia University law professor Michael Dorff points out, the Supreme Court ruled in U.S. v. Nixon. And this was the case where the Supreme Court forced Nixon to give up the White House tapes. The Supreme Court ruled in the U.S. v. Nixon, quote, where the president asserts only a generalized need for confidentiality, in other words, executive privilege, must yield to the interests of the government and defendants in a criminal prosecution. So the Supreme Court has already ruled in the case that involved Richard Nixon when they said, no, you stand accused of a crime, Mr. President, and so you cannot assert confidentiality because there is evidence, there's actually probable cause, back to the Fourth Amendment. There is enough evidence that a judge, that somebody will swear under oath and a judge will issue a warrant because there is probable cause that a crime has been committed. So we are now undergoing a criminal investigation. And if it is a criminal investigation of the behavior of the President of the United States, the President of the United States has no right to claim executive privilege. Period. It's gone. End of discussion. I mean, it's gone. So, and frankly, I think this might be part of the reason why Cheney is saying that he's not part of the executive branch, because he's not going to try and claim executive privilege, because then, well, you know, hey, we're looking into crimes that you committed. And there's no shortage of them, starting with this investigation into the illegal wiretapping. And here you have a professor of law at the George Washington University, Jonathan Turley, respected, serious, solid guy, constitutional scholar, saying, we've been saying for years that George W. Bush ordered people under him to commit a felony. Now, that in and of itself is a felony, plus they all committed felonies. So here we have multiple hundreds of people involved in a criminal conspiracy to commit felonies thousands of times. By the way, Louise lets me know lying to a federal officer and lying under oath is a felony. So Bill Clinton was a felony as well. So, but nonetheless, Jonathan Turley says this is, you know, there's no doubt that committing a crime of this magnitude, a felony of this magnitude, particularly a law that specifies any federal officer, which would include the president, is an impeachable offense. Which brings us back to the issue of impeachment. But maybe by the back door, maybe without ever even mentioning the word impeachment, all Pat Leahy has to do now, or all John Conyers, Pat Leahy, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, or Judiciary Committee, rather, and John Conyers, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, all they have to do now is say, okay, we are investigating. In fact, now let's impanel a special prosecutor. We are investigating a crime committed by the executive branch, by the President of the United States. And therefore, you may not assert executive privilege, and you must turn those papers over to us. Then the question becomes, how many of those emails will have been deleted? How many of those papers will have been shredded? You had the 18-and-a-half-minute gap with Rosemary Woods. You had the thousands of documents that were shredded by Ollie North to defend Reagan and Bush Sr. And now we've got, you know, millions of emails deleted by the Republican National Committee. How much of this stuff is already gone? 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
A lot of news out there, by the way. 20 beheaded bodies discovered in the Tigris River. Yesterday, the day before, there was a story in I believe it was the New York Times, about how, might have been the Financial Times, about how Iraqis used to love to eat fish out of the river, but they don't anymore because there's so many bodies, human bodies being found, that the river is so badly contaminated by bloated bodies that they can't eat the fish from the river anymore. I mean, that's what we have brought to Iraq. Barack Obama, 138,000 more donors, moving ahead, moving along. John Edwards, of course, not taking money from PACs and from corporations, will probably come in number three in the money race. Obama and Clinton probably number one and two. We'll see how this shakes out. And perhaps most significantly, there's two stories that are I think really significant. Number one, the immigration bill has collapsed in the United States Senate, fell apart. And oddly enough, the ACLU has issued a news release about this. The ACLU coming out and saying that this bill died because our Senate did not take the difficult steps required to actually fix our immigration system to make it fair, just, and workable. Lawmakers take note, any new immigration reform will fail if it erodes our constitutional rights to judicial review, privacy, and due process. Well said. This immigration bill, I was opposed to it because it had become a compromise that was destructive to immigrants, destructive to the American middle class, destructive to working people in the United States, destructive to everybody except transnational corporations and large employers. And, it wasn't working for anybody. And, now it's gone down, and I say, good riddance. And if we're going to do amnesty, then let's just do it. And if we're not, then let's start putting employers in jail. I mean, it really should come down to one of those two decisions. You're either going to enforce the law, and frankly, enforcing the law by, hunting down people who look like they're Hispanic and going, show me some ID. This whole Real ID Act and all this stuff, criminalizing individuals. Give me a break. We do not have an illegal immigration problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States. And we need to be honest with ourselves about it and say that people would not come here if something wasn't being offered them if they came here. And what's being offered to them is jobs. And it's not even, and it's not that this old saw that John McCain tried to trot out that, well, there's some jobs that Americans just won't do. I'm sorry, there are none. There is no such thing as a job an American won't do for the right price. He said, I could offer $50 an hour to pick lettuce in Arizona and nobody would do it. And his office was flooded with people from all across the United States saying, I'll pick lettuce for $50 an hour. Oh, but then everybody's lettuce is going to become more expensive. Well, yeah, but if all of us have a better paycheck, we can afford better lettuce. Well, isn't that inflationary? Well, no, not necessarily. If it keeps, in fact, it actually may be stimulative. It may strengthen the economy. The supply siders, the Chicago School of Economics, Milton Friedman Economics, that have dominated American political thought since the early 1980s, are just wrong. And we're seeing it. It's resulting in the wiping out of the American middle class. We need to go back and re-examine what John Maynard Keynes said. He was the guy who was the deep thinker behind the New Deal. He was the guy that basically built, on his thinking, that built the modern American and Western European and Japanese middle class. And go back to that. And frankly, immigration is part of that. The equation of labor versus the demand for labor. We need to, and even that doesn't exist in a vacuum. We also need to be looking at our trade policies. Are we going to be offshoring jobs at the same, our manufacturing jobs at the same time that we're inshoring labor to compete with our service jobs, all in an effort to drive down the cost of American labor, to destroy the American middle class? And why would anybody want to destroy the American middle class, you say? Well, because when you have people who are disempowered, they cease to be politically active. They're too busy trying to make a living. They're scared to death. I mean, there is a certain threshold you don't want to pass. The French passed it in 1789 and it led to the French Revolution, where people were, they had bread riots. You had food riots. I mean, you don't want people starving. But England did this dance the United Kingdom very effectively for many hundreds of years with their maximum wage laws to prevent a middle class from emerging because they didn't want political activism. The two high points of political activism in the United States just happen to correspond to the two high points of there being an American middle class, the 1770s and the 1970s. The first middle class came about as a result of a lot of free land free in quotes, and slave labor. And the second middle class came about as a result of Franklin Roosevelt rewriting the rules of capitalism. And if we want to have a middle class back, we need to really seriously be looking at how Roosevelt did that and how Keynes did that, and reject these ideas of Milton Friedman and Alan Greenspan and Ronald Reagan at all. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And as we lie beneath the stars, we realize how small we are. If they could love like you and me, imagine what the world could be.
Oh, if only people would do right, yeah? Well, there's some folks out there keeping the world right, keeping us informed, helping us know what's going on. Thus, our Best of the Rest of the News segment. Every week we get a couple of folks from the Internet, the blogosphere, the cybersphere or something like that. Paul Waldman is with us with MediaMatters.org. He's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America. His latest book is Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. MediaMatters.org. Hey, Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. And Christy Smith is with us. She is a blogger at FireDogLake.com and a former prosecutor. Christy, welcome.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you both with us. Paul, let me start with you. First, congratulations, I think, are in order. Media Matters for America succeeded in getting Tavis Smiley's producer to drop Frank Luntz from appearing in this Democratic forum. Number one, good on you. And number two, how did that come about in the first place? Is this more evidence of the takeover of public broadcasting by the right now that the Republicans have installed Republican operatives at the very top levels of it?
Well, one has to wonder what exactly was going through PBS's mind, but they announced a little while ago that there's a debate of the Democratic candidates that's going to be taking place tonight, and they said that Frank Luntz was going to be doing a focus group and offering commentary, and then was going to be appearing on Tavis Smiley's show tomorrow night. Then they came out and said that no, he's not going to be appearing tonight, although he will be doing Tavis Smiley's show tomorrow. So we don't know exactly what the details of what he was supposed to do originally were, but the fact is that for those people who don't know, Frank Luntz is a notorious Republican pollster. He has been reprimanded by the American Association for Public Opinion Research over his methodology. He is one of the people behind the Contract with America in 1994, and he was Rudy Giuliani's pollster for the last three of Giuliani's campaigns, which makes you wonder why they chose him to come on and do analysis of the Democratic debate. You know, I live in Washington. This place is full of pollsters. You could have gotten a Republican and a Democrat. You could have gotten a nonpartisan pollster. But for some reason, PBS decided that Frank Luntz was the guy they wanted to go to.
Yeah, it's very strange. And in fact, Luntz was also the guy who came up with the concept of death tax. I mean, he's not just been a pollster. He has reinvented language in many cases.
Right. That's the big thing.
Go ahead, Paul.
No, I was going to say that's what Luntz is known for, is telling Republicans to use those kinds of manipulations of language instead of calling it the estate tax, call it the death tax. You know, and this is something that with his help they've gotten very good at, and why now, you know, when George Bush wants to cut down forests, he calls it the Healthy Forests Initiative. When he wants to cut down on environmental regulations, he calls it the Clear Skies Initiative. All of that kind of thing comes from Frank Luntz. He's the one who taught them how to do it.
Right, but he's still apparently going to be part of public broadcasting. It's absolutely bizarre. Paul, what do you see as the top story in today's news from the point of view of Media Matters for America?
Well, one of the top stories today has to be the fallout from the Ann Coulter, Elizabeth Edwards contretemps on Hardball yesterday. And, you know, we've been talking about Ann Coulter for a long time and asking the question of why these media companies keep bringing her on to places like Hardball, to places like Good Morning America and the Today Show, when she can be counted on to come out and spew all kinds of hate. And then when they get questioned on it, they one of the things you often hear from them, and I heard this from David Gregory talking about it this morning when he was interviewing Elizabeth Edwards on the Today Show, was, well, you know, there's this kind of nasty rhetoric on the right and on the left. And the fact is that that's just not true. I mean, can you name me somebody on the left who gets to go on places like the Today Show and regularly advocates the murder of people they disagree with? Because that's what Ann Coulter does again and again and again. You know, this thing with John Edwards is not the first time. She has advocated the murder of journalists. She advocated the assassination of Bill Clinton. All kinds of people. She advocated the poisoning of Justice John Paul Stevens. That's a regular part of her rhetoric, and it's this kind of incredibly hateful stuff, and yet they keep bringing her on again and again and again,
yeah.
And don't seem to want to take any responsibility for their role in contributing to this kind of debasement of our discourse.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I have some audio of this. Well, we'll get to it a little bit later because I want to get Christy in here. But good point, Paul, and well made. And that is that the so-called mainstream media has become so right that they think that Ann Coulter is normal, and it's absolutely bizarre. Christy Smith over at FireDogLake.com. You guys do absolutely great blogging. You've reported for us on several major events that have been breaking over the last few months, the last 6 months or so. What do you see as the top story from the point of view of FireDogLake.com?
There are a couple today, Tom. One of them is the continuing opinions that have been coming out from the Supreme Court this week. You've seen a lot of 5-4 decisions, which have come out, several of which have reversed longtime precedent, including a couple today, one based on a Seattle case and one based on a case out of Louisville, Kentucky, which undercut a lot of the underpinnings that were put forward by the Warren Court in the Brown versus Board of Education case, which is a bedrock case, one of the principles of law, which has stood since its decision, as one of those things that I think all Americans have agreed was a huge step forward in undercutting segregation in the public schools and, you know, completely undermining the separate but equal decisions that had dominated, especially the southern United States, in terms of how schooling was done. I have a picture up today of Thurgood Marshall standing on the steps of the Supreme Court the day that Brown v. Board of Education was decided, and the joy on his face and the faces of the other two attorneys from the NAACP, you know, I look at that and it just makes me feel hollow thinking about this decision today.
Mm, yeah. And the second story you said?
The second story, I think, is the White House's continuing attempt to basically block any oversight by Congress of the U.S. attorney firing specifically today. But I think that that's probably a maneuver to also block any oversight on the NSA domestic spying issue. The Committee on Government Oversight in the House, which is Representative Waxman's committee, was set to issue subpoenas today to the White House and to other executive agencies on the domestic spying issue. They've held off on doing that because the White House counsel sent a letter to both Representative Conyers and Senator Leahy, who are the two chairs of the House and Senate Judiciary Committee, saying that the White House was not going to comply with prior subpoenas that both committees had sent out on the U.S. attorney firings.
Right.
So
yeah.
Both of those are huge issues today.
Yeah, it seems to me that what Jonathan Turley was talking about last night on Hardball with Keith Olbermann is the way to pursue this, is to say, okay, what we're pursuing now is a criminal investigation, which is the violation of the FISA law, and therefore executive privilege under U.S. v. Nixon, executive privilege no longer exists. You must comply.
I would love to see them make that argument. I would also like to see them go further with that. Patrick Fitzgerald, who you know was doing the investigation in the Tradergate matter that ultimately led to the indictment and then the conviction of Scooter Libby, had a number of documents that his team seized from Karl Rove under subpoena that were emails and other information that they got from Rove during the course of their investigation from his RNC-issued BlackBerry and his RNC-issued email accounts. Those are still currently under seal in terms of grand jury, but there are ways to get around that under Rule 6E and other rules that allow for the Department of Justice to give copies of those to Congress.
Sure. Once you make it a criminal matter. Paul Waldman from MediaMatters.org. Paul, what do you see as the major under the radar story right now that's percolating, or stories that you see coming down the road here, looking into the future?
Well, I think that we obviously are going to be spending a lot of attention to the presidential campaign, and there's things happening all the time. You know, for instance, just the other day, Rudy Giuliani went to give a speech at Regent University, Pat Robertson's university, and all the coverage was about how he's just trying to reach out to the base without almost anyone noting that Pat Robertson is, quite frankly, a raving lunatic. And it
he's,
really
he's not the base.
About whether or not Rudy Giuliani should be consorting with someone like this. That's something that I think, you know, there are a number of cases like that where Republican candidates for president are reaching out to people who have extraordinarily radical views, and it's just not really getting covered. So that's something that we're going to be trying to bring attention to.
Yeah, and it kind of raises the question of what is the base and how crazed is the base of the Republican Party. Christy Smith, we just have a minute here left. FireDogLake.com. Christy, what do you see as the major stories coming down the road that we should be attending to that perhaps aren't getting the attention they need?
I'm sitting here laughing at Paul because Regent University gave us the ethical stylings of Monica Goodling at the Department of Justice. So
yeah, or you mean laughing with Paul? Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So, but you know, I think there's another issue that's under the radar at the moment. One of the things that came along with Fred Fielding's letter to both of the Judiciary Committee chairmen was an attached letter from Paul Clement, who is supposed to be investigating the U.S. attorney firings at the Department of Justice with the Office of Legal Counsel. Well, you know, he's supporting the White House position. So, how effective do you think he's doing his internal investigation of the Department of Justice at this point? I think that that's going to open a huge can of worms, and the White House should have thought before they attached a letter from him.
Holy cow. That's, yeah. Can you spell conflict of interest? Christy Smith.
Yeah, I can.
Christy Smith, FireDogLake.com. Paul Waldman, MediaMatters.org, and also his latest book, Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Successes. Paul and Christy, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Good talk. Indeed. Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
It's like everything and nothing leads to wisdom. It's like no one really meant what they meant. It's like every man's a king, every house a kingdom. It's like Joe McCarthy was our acting president. Everything's okay in the USA, in the good old USA.
Hey, congratulations to Math Boy. You posted the blog over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page that David's selected today as the top. So congratulations, Mathboy. Indeed, well done. Mathboy said, this advertising thing relates to Tom's idea that progressives try to organize society to let people fulfill their potential. Conservatives today put a lot of effort into convincing people to feel good when they're consumers. Progressives, on the other hand, want people to feel good when they're producers. That is, when they create something that has real value. Consumerism versus producerism. The imbalance between those attitudes is so strong that one of them is a word and the other isn't. Well said, Mathboy. Also, an interesting post over at the blog that just goes to show what, you know, how easily, I guess, misunderstood some of this is, or maybe this is just from somebody who hasn't listened to the program a lot and doesn't really get my position on this. But this person posted a blog, M. Stagger Leap, says, irony, after Tom, one, simultaneously demonizes the corporatocracy, and two, tells us the best way to support Air America is to patronize their sponsors, an ad comes on the web stream from an outfit called the Corporation Company, whose product is a kit describing how to incorporate your small business. So are corporations good or bad? The answer obviously is yes. Peace, you know, M. Stagger Lee, and then he says, of course, the new right is wrong, but that doesn't mean the wrong, the new right. Here's my point. I am not opposed to the corporate form. And in fact, I've used the Corporation Company to create corporations. There you go. I am not opposed to free enterprise. I'm not opposed to capitalism. What I'm opposed to is absolutely unrestrained laissez-faire capitalism, where the needs of corporations to generate profit are put above the needs of society for the survival of humans and all other life on Earth. So what I'm in favor of is what is known broadly as regulated capitalism, which is what we had in the United States from 1932. It's what we had in the United States from the founding of this country up until the Civil War, and what we had in this country from 1932 to 1981. Corporations can do well. They can do well doing good, and they can do good doing well, but only when their intrinsically sociopathic behavior, that is, their single focus on profit, is tempered by laws that require them to behave in ways that don't entirely externalize costs, that is, you know, dumping their toxic pollution on us for the taxpayers to pick up, for example, and behave in ways that actually serve the public good as well as make a profit. And it's entirely possible. It's been done before. And it's being done all over the world. Look at you know, what's going on in most of the Western European countries. Sweden is obviously the best example of this, but there's other examples all over the world. So anyhow, that's my take on that. And I just want to make it very clear where I stand. I'm not anti-corporate. I own a corporation. This show is owned by a corporation called Mythical Research Inc. It's a company that I own. It's a corporation. I own this show. It's a corporation. I'm not opposed to the corporate form. I do think, however, that corporations should exist, and in order to incorporate, because we the people, the government of the United States, and specifically the state in which I incorporated, gave me certain limitations of liability, I believe that as a corporation I should have certain responsibilities. And I don't think that the responsibility end of it has been held up since 1982, 1981. In fact, Reagan started taking that apart, and it's been taken apart more and more and more as time has gone on. Lewis in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Lewis, what's on your mind today? Lewis? No, Lewis. I'm not hearing anything coming back from Air America. Okay. We got no Lewis. Okay. Bill in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bill.
Hello there. Tom, love you. I love your show. I love what your mission is. This weekend, I spent 3 days with senior department state officials, two 25-year career men, one of them an evangelical Christian who prefaced our meeting with a mea culpa for voting for this president twice. But to the point, I think this is illuminating to our scenario right now as far as what the executive branch is trying to do as far as our subpoena situation right now.
Right.
Cheney just toured the Middle East. These men both have had senior posts in the Middle East for over 25 years. Both of them officially supported this administration. Now they said amongst the State Department, their code name for Cheney is Darth Vader. I said, why? They said, because he is the dark force. Cheney tours the Middle East with over 100 advanced people, unheard of for any VP to ever do such a thing. Most of them RNC operatives, vetting these senior officials whom were insulted and feel betrayed. Their opinions, they said, are no longer even requested, asked for. The DOD is running the Department of State, if you will. These men feel marginalized. They feel that the war has gone so astray and so much that it's unwinnable. These are men.
These are State Department officials you were talking with?
Yes. Yeah. Who happen to be family members who I have been somewhat ostracized from because, I can't communicate with them in anything.
Well, I think a lot of people in the State Department are very, and frankly, a lot of people in the Pentagon are very upset that Dick Cheney, that the office of the vice president, has been taken upon himself the powers that should be in those cabinet offices.
Well, I mean, this was their opinion, and I have heard them at other times speak in favor of this administration years ago. Now they feel as if they were bamboozled and betrayed. But the whole thing was so negative. Their view on is there an out to in Iraq? I said, gosh, there's got to be some sort of silver lining. One of these men, evangelical Christian, one Jewish, said the only out is for us to treat these Middle Eastern countries with some degree of dignity, which this administration refuses to do.
Good point, Bill. Bill, I'm sorry, we've got to wrap it up here. Coming up tomorrow, Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie Hour, plus Michael Moore is going to drop by and say hi, and it's Anything Goes Friday. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.